From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, country singer Ray Price discusses his 50 years in the business and his friend and mentor Hank Williams, who got Price onto the stage of the Grand Ole Opry. Price tried to keep Williams from drinking and covered for him when he couldn't perform. We'll listen to some of Price's old and new recordings. Also, Sean Penn talks with us about his two new movies, Hurly Burly and The Thin Red Line. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The impeachment trial of President Clinton has concluded for the day after the Senate heard from White House counsel Charles Ruff, who began the argument in President Clinton's defense. NPR's Madeline Brand reports.
Charles Ruff sat in the well of the Senate and addressed the lawmakers for more than 2.5 hours. In a sharp attack, he called the House prosecutor's case against the president a witch's brew of charges based on sandcastles of speculation. Ruff challenged the accusation that the president tried to buy Monica Lewinsky's silence with a job, noting that President Clinton's friend Vernon Jordan had made calls to prospective employers before learning that the judge in the Paula Jones case had allowed Lewinsky to testify. Ruff concluded his presentation by saying the president did nothing illegal.
You must find that it's the only solution, that our democracy should not be made to sustain 2 more years of this president's service.
The White House defense is expected to continue tomorrow with special counsel Gregory Craig and deputy counsel Cheryl Mills. Madeline Brand, NPR News, Washington.
The Yugoslav government will reportedly allow the head of the international observer team in Kosovo to remain in the country for at least another day. William Walker, an American diplomat, was ordered yesterday to get out of Yugoslavia within 48 hours after he blamed Serbian forces for the massacre of more than 40 ethnic Albanian civilians. According to a Yugoslav state news agency, the government has now agreed to give Walker an additional 24 hours. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has insisted that Yugoslavia rescind its expulsion order entirely. The State Department says 2 top NATO generals are on their way back to Brussels after meeting with Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, reportedly with a warning to stop his troops' current offensive in Kosovo. Spokesman James Rubin said initial reports about the meeting were not encouraging. In Havana, the Baltimore Orioles have reached a provisional agreement to play 2 exhibition games with the Cuban national team this spring. Still to be worked out are important differences over where the game's profits should go. Tom Gibb reports from Havana.
Dates of the games have been set for late March and early April to be played in Havana and Baltimore. If they go ahead, the Orioles will be the first major league team to play on the communist-ruled island since 1947. Orioles owner Peter Angelos says the idea is to bring Cubans and Americans closer together. In the past, such sports exchanges have been stopped by the U.S. embargo against Cuba, but this year the games have more chance of success under an initiative announced by President Clinton earlier this month to increase contacts with the island. For NPR News, this is Tom Gibb in Havana.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 9,355 in heavy trading. This is NPR. President Clinton will reportedly focus on Social Security in his State of the Union address, scheduled to begin in 2 hours. He's expected to outline a plan to spend some $2.7 trillion from projected government budget surpluses on the retirement fund over the next 15 years. As much as a quarter of that money would be invested in the stock market based on the recommendations of an independent board. The Supreme Court has agreed to resolve a long-running dispute between Kansas and Nebraska over the use of water from the Republican River. Russell Lewis reports from Kansas Public Radio.
Kansas is accusing Nebraska of violating a 1943 interstate compact by allowing Nebraskans to divert 10 billion gallons of water from the river for their private use. Kansas officials say that's helping to dry up fields because Kansas farmers are prevented from drilling new irrigation wells. State officials also say the restriction of water is impacting public drinking supplies as far as 100 miles from the Nebraska border. Mary Horsch is with the Kansas Attorney General's office.
It's very important that Kansas have its fair share of the river water, and we're not getting that now. We haven't gotten it for dozens of years.
Nebraska officials contend Kansas has already received its fair share of water from the Republican River. The resolution of cases like this one usually takes years. For NPR News, I'm Russell Lewis in Topeka, Kansas.
In stocks today, a surge in internet stocks sent the NASDAQ Composite Index to a record high with a gain of 60 points, or 2.5%, to close at 2,408. The Dow Industrials gained 15 points to close at 9,355. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Ray Price was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1996, he was described by Kris Kristofferson as a living link from Hank Williams to the country music of today. Price was Hank Williams' protege and roommate in the early 50s after Price moved to Nashville. Soon after, Price helped give several country performers their starts. Early in their careers, Willie Nelson, Roger Miller, Johnny Paycheck, and Johnny Bush played in Price's band, the Cherokee Cowboys. Price was born in Cherokee County, Texas, in 1926. His country hits have included Crazy Arms, Release Me, Heartaches by the Number, and For the Good Times. In a Washington Post review of a concert last year, Price was praised for singing ballads with a quiet soulfulness that now sounds refreshingly old-fashioned. You can hear that for yourself on his forthcoming CD. From it, this is Rambling Rose.
Ramblin' Rose, Ramblin' Rose, why you ramble, no one knows. Wild and windblown, that's how you've grown. Who can cling to a rambling rose? Ramble on, ramble on. When you're rambling, days are gone. Who will love you with a love true? When you're rambling, days are gone. Ramblin' Rose.
That's Ray Price from his new CD. Ray Price, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm really anxious to hear why you decided to record Ramblin' Rose, and I'll preface my question by saying that, you know, I know Nat King Cole's recording, and although I love Nat Cole, that's one recording I never loved, yet I really love the way you do the song. So what did you hear in the song?
Well, it's just a great song, really. It's kind of like a young girl that might be heading in the wrong direction, I think. And oh, that's the way I look at it. I'm trying to make it sound as real as I can.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your past. I know you grew up in Texas. Where did you grow up, and what was that community like?
Well, I came from Northeast Texas, which was then Wood County and Upshur County. It's a rural area, and my family were all farmers on both sides. And then my mother and dad moved to Dallas, and of course I went to Dallas with them. And I was raised in Dallas and went to college in Arlington, Texas. But I'm back in East Texas now living. So it's a pretty part of the state.
One of the people who helped you a lot early in your career was Hank Williams. the great country singer. How did you meet him?
Well, the music publisher in Nashville, who got me a contract with Columbia Records, got me on one of Hank's radio shows. Every Friday night in Nashville, they would, if the stars were in town, they would be on their own radio shows at WSM in Nashville. And I was a guest. The music publisher, Troy Martin, had gotten me in a spot on his show, and I met him. And we became real close friends, and he got me on the Grand Ole Opry. And he and his wife were getting divorced, and I lived with
him. Hank Williams got you on the Grand Ole Opry?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And then we lived together. We had a house there in Nashville, and I had the upstairs. He had the lower for about a year, and then, of course, he passed away.
And you're saying that you started living together after he and his wife separated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had to have somebody. He had a problem with alcohol, and we were real close, and I'd take care of him. Everything was fine.
What would you do for him?
Oh, just whatever needed to be done, like go to the store and things like that.
Would you try to keep him from alcohol or keep him comfortable with it? Or?
Well, yeah, but you just don't do... Oh, no, I wouldn't give him anything. No way. But, yeah, like any of your friends, if they got into it too far, you'd try to help them if they were ill.
Now, I read someplace, and you could tell me if this is true, because there's so many legends surrounding famous people, but I read that Hank Williams tried to shoot you a couple of times, that he shot at you a couple of times.
No, honey, that is a real big prevarication.
Okay.
Real big. No way.
Okay.
It had to come from somebody that may have been a little envious back there somewhere.
Right.
It really didn't happen. The reason why that Hank and I stopped living together right at the last was the fact that he was in the hospital so many times and having so much trouble. And one of the times I was ordered by the man, Jim Denny, who ran the Artist Service Bureau in Nashville and handled Hank to take him to the hospital. And Hank got a little ill at me for that, and so I moved. But we never lost the friendship we had.
Did he help you get on the Grand Ole Opry the first time?
Sure did.
What did he do to get you on there? Were you performing in his act or opening for him? Or?
No, it was one Saturday night, Red Foley, who was one of the big stars in the star of the Prince Albert, which was the network show. Wife had died, and Hank had took the host position on the show, and he wanted me for his guest. And you didn't get on the Grand Ole Opry back then without a hit record, and I was years away from a hit record. But he got me on, and they sent me to take care of him on a trip one time, and everything worked out all right, so they signed me to a contract.
What do you mean they sent you to take care of him on a trip? They knew that he was having problems and he needed kind of like a guardian?
Yeah, and he needed somebody to get up and sing in case he didn't make it, and that was hard to do. That happened to me in Norfolk on New Year's Day, and I didn't know what to do because they come running in and said, well, you're going to have to take Hank's place. And here I was. Nobody even knew who I was. And I said, well, there's no way I can do that. But anyway, they put me out there with Hank's band, and we made it all right. And the people kind of liked me because I had made a mistake by naming one of the songs in a higher key than I would have been. And I let them know about it. So it turned kind of amusing for a while. And from then on, Norfolk was one of the best towns for me.
How would you explain it to the audience that Hank Williams couldn't make it?
Well, you let the promoter do that. And there were other stars on the show, Johnny and Jack, Kitty Wells, and we were all trying to cover up the fact because it was 10 or 12,000 people there. And the promoter went out and I forget what he said, that Hank was ill or something. But some of the times, Hank wouldn't even be drinking, and the promoters would get him to drinking so they didn't have to pay him.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding, honey.
So this way they'd get all the ticket sales, but they wouldn't have to pay him.
Well, they wouldn't have to pay him because he breached his contract. He come in there and got drunk, didn't do a good show. But they'd put him on the stage while he's inebriated, and nobody can get on the stage and sing drunk.
Uh-huh. But in the meanwhile, the promoter would have had maybe a full house and made all the money on the ticket sale.
$50,000 or $60,000, put in his pocket and go home.
Huh. Let's pause here for some music and hear one of your early hits. In fact, this was your first number one recording. This is called Crazy Arms. It was recorded in 1956. Do you want to say anything about the recording before we hear it?
Well, yeah. it was in 1956, and Bob Martin, a disc jockey in Tampa, Florida, had found a record of Crazy Arms. And it wasn't a very good record. But he was intrigued by the song, and he played it for me, and I was too. And then when I recorded it, it became a monster. It was my first million seller, and it crossed over. And at that time, they didn't know what a crossover was. But it was the first big one I had, you're right.
Let's hear it. This is my guest, Ray Price, recorded in 1956. Price recorded in 1956. What was the impact of having a number one hit?
Well, I got to eat pretty regular.
Were you having trouble doing that before?
Oh, yeah. All young ones have trouble. In fact, Lefty Frizzell and I started out together, and we used to split a bowl of stew in Dallas when we were first starting. But everything got better, and like it always does. And I don't know, that's about all I can say. It gave me an opportunity to do things that I hadn't been able to do up to that point.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Ray Price. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is country singer Ray Price. Now, I believe after Hank Williams died, you used his band for a while.
I used his band for about 2 years, and there's two or three of them that's passed on now, but the rest of them, we're all dear friends. But I got to sounding too much like Hank on records, and it was because the music was so locked in, it had to sound like Hank, and we had to break up. And broke up in Grand Junction, Colorado, if I remember correctly.
Did you feel that your singing style changed when you got your own band?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How did it change?
Well, I went back to singing Texas style. And not the way Hank and the band played. He had no drums or anything like that. And, of course, I brought a Texas swing band to Nashville to go to work with me. And from then on, that's the way it was. That's where I earned the title as the number one honky-tonk player, because that's the only place you could play at that time was in the nightclubs.
We mentioned Western Swing. You did an album, I think it was in the late 1950s, of songs that were first recorded by Bob Wills, the kind of father of Western Swing. Did you ever know him?
Oh, yeah, I knew Bob real well. When I was first starting in Dallas, he had a nightclub called Bob Wills Ranch House. It later became another nightclub after he left it. But when he was on the road with his band, he would always let me and a band play in his place. He did me a big favor. And, of course, that was my tribute to him, was that album.
Well, this album features the band that you put together after you used the Hank Williams band, or one of the versions of the band you put together, and Willie Nelson is in this band. You had several really great people in your band. Johnny Bush was in your band for a while, the great singer.
Roger Miller was the front man.
Yeah, how did you find these people who became so famous in their own right? How did you end up having them as sidemen in your band?
Well, they were all looking for a job, Terry. Everything was tough back there. And I hired Roger. He was working in the fire department in Amarillo, Texas. And I needed a fiddle player, and he came out to play fiddle. And his fiddle playing was terrible. And when he got through, he said, "How'd you like that?" And I said, "Well, can you sing and play guitar?" And it kind of shook him, and he said, "Yeah." So I hired him as a front man.
Huh.
And he did real well. Roger and I were real close, just like Willie and I are still close.
Well, it sounded like you were determined to hire him, whether he was good or not.
Well, I had heard him sing.
Oh, okay, yeah. And had you heard Willie Nelson sing before you hired him?
Well, Willie worked for my publishing company, Pamper Music.
Oh, so you knew his songs.
Oh, yeah, all of them. And, of course, Willie was having a hard time, too. And Johnny Paycheck had gone out on his own, and Willie replaced Johnny Paycheck on bass, and then he would play guitar sometimes.
So let's hear something from this Bob Wills tribute album, the one where Willie Nelson's featured in the band. And I just looked at the recording date on this. It was recorded in 1961, and I thought we'd hear Time Changes Everything. You want to say anything about it?
Just a great song.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here we go.
Country-wise.
This is Ray Price.
There was a time when I thought of no other, and we sang our own love's refrain. Our hearts beat as one as we had our fun, but time changes everything. When you left me, my poor heart was broken. Our romance seemed all in vain. The dark clouds are gone and there's blue skies again. Our time changes everything.
That's Ray Price from his 1961 album, San Antonio Rose. It's a tribute to Bob Wills, and it's been reissued in the past couple of years. Was that Willie Nelson singing harmony, by the way?
Could have been. Now, Willie and I recorded a San Antonio Rose album around 1979, I think.
Yeah, that was a big hit on the country charts.
It was a big one, real big.
Now, in the mid-60s or so, you started using more heavily arranged settings, you know, strings and orchestras, moving away from a more honky-tonk kind of sound. What led you in that direction?
The honky-tonks.
What do you mean?
Yeah, it wasn't fun playing honky-tonks, and I was trying to broaden my audience out. Also, I thought that if country music was going to really win approval all over the country, they had to do something to kind of fix it where the people that listened to the Tony Bennett's and the Frank Sinatra's and those people would like the song or the music. And country music songs are great. I think they're beautiful songs, and to put the strings with them, that's my idea of how to make one really a great song.
And did that work for you? Did it get you where you wanted to be in venues that other pop singers were singing?
Well, it got me on a lot of places, yeah. Sure did. I became one of Johnny Carson's favorite singers, which I'm very proud of. And I did a lot of things with him in New York before he moved to California and afterwards. But Yeah, it got me where I wanted to be, and I got out of the honky tonks, and I still play dances every now and then for some of my old fans, but I'm not really into that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of country music performers who are, you know, acknowledged as being, you know, among the greats, who don't get played much on country music radio anymore, including Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson. Do you feel that you're in that predicament as well?
Well, yeah, I'm in the same box. That all is brought down from the higher-ups in the industry, which I guess would be New York or L.A., and they felt like they could make a whole lot of money, more money with the young kids playing rock music, but they had to name it something besides rock or it wouldn't sell. And so they named it country music, but it's really rock music. It's the old Beatles sound.
So I take it it's a sound you don't much like or don't feel that you perform anyways.
No, I like the Beatles. I like the Beatles. I think they ought to play the Beatles. They don't need to play the rest of them. The Beatles have already done it. Now, that sounds hateful, and I'm sorry for that.
I want to get back to your new CD. And as I mentioned earlier, some of the songs on here are jazz and pop standards. And I thought I'd play another that fits in that category. This is the song Prisoner of Love. Tell me why you decided to sing this.
Just a great song. I remember back years ago when Perry Como recorded it.
Mm-hmm. Did you like Perry Como?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've never heard it with this kind of band, a kind of like shuffle beat behind it before.
That's the old price beat, they call that.
Uh-huh.
And then we thought it would fit, so we put it in there.
It works very nicely. So why don't we hear it? And Ray Price, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's my pleasure. Thank you, dear.
Ray Price's forthcoming CD is expected to be released in the spring. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Alone from night to night, you'll find me. Too weak to break the chains that bind me. I need no shackles to remind me. I'm just a prisoner of love. For one command I stand and wait now, from one who's master of my fate now. I can't escape, for it's too late now. I'm just a prisoner of love. What's the good of my caring if someone is sharing those arms?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Little Brown & Company, publisher of Peter Garonick's follow-up to Last Train to Memphis, Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Sean Penn talks with us about his two new movies, Hurly Burly and The Thin Red Line. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sean Penn is starring in two new movies. Neither is typical Hollywood fare. He plays a sergeant in the World War II movie The Thin Red Line. It's director Terrence Malick's first movie in about 20 years. The story follows an Army rifle company that's sent to the South Sea island of Guadalcanal, which has been invaded by the Japanese. In this scene, Penn's character, Sergeant Edward Welsh, is reprimanding a soldier in his company, Private Witt, played by Jim Caviezel. Private Witt is back in the company after having gone AWOL.
Truth is, you can't take straight duty in my company. You'll never be a real soldier. Not in God's world. This is C Company, of which I'm first sergeant. I run this outfit. Now, Captain Starles, he's the CO. But I'm the guy who runs it. Nobody's gonna foul that up. You're just another mouth for me to feed. Normally, you'd be court-martialed. But I worked a deal for you. You ought to consider yourself lucky. I'm sending you to a disciplinary outfit. You'll be a stretcher bearer. You'll be taking care of the wounded.
I can take anything you dish out. I'm twice the man you are.
Sean Penn's other new movie, Hurly Burly, is based on a play by David Rabe. It's about three friends in Hollywood and their relationships with women. In this scene, Penn has learned that his roommate, played by Kevin Spacey, has spent the night with Penn's girlfriend. Here's Penn and Spacey on the telephone.
Yeah.
Look, I'm not claiming any reprehensible behavior on anybody's part.
I mean, we're all sophisticated people. Darlene and I certainly had no exclusive commitment to each other of any kind whatsoever, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying.
No confusion here, Mickey. Just have a little empathy, for Christ's sake. I mean, I bring home this very special lady to meet my best friend, my roommate.
Eddie, why do we have to go through this?
I'm just trying to tell a story here, Mickey. Nobody's to blame, and certainly not you. I mean,
you came to me. You had experienced these vibes between yourself and Darlene. Isn't that what you said?
Yeah, but couldn't you have said no? Couldn't you have categorically, definitively said no when I asked? But you said...
Eddie, you said everybody's free, Mickey. I mean, that is what you said.
Look, I just want to verify for you, Mickey. Everybody is free.
So what's this, then?
You mean this conversation?
Yeah.
This is just me trying to maintain a, you know, viable relationship with reality. Okay, I want to make sure I haven't drifted off into some solitary, paranoid fantasy system of my own totally unfounded and idiosyncratic invention.
I want to be in reality, you know? Don't you want me to be in reality? Personally, I want us both to be in reality. Come on!
Well, absolutely, that's what I want, Eddie. I want us both to be in reality. Absolutely.
Sean Penn, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to talk first about your new movie, Hurly Burly. The story is set in Hollywood. You play a casting agent. The story is about, like, three guys who are, or four guys, I should say, who are particularly self-absorbed, self-destructive, and very misogynistic, and very kind of caught up in the kind of cocaine ethos of the period in the 80s when the play was first produced. I'm wondering if you relate to these characters, if you feel like you know characters like this.
Well, I mean, in your description, you know, there's this word that has come up several times about relative to this play having to do with, you know, misogyny. I think that the play makes its own case that it's really not, that it doesn't really reflect the characters, because there's nobody with whom they treat with less respect and or more viciousness than themselves and each other, the men amongst themselves and each other. And I think that there was actually the New York Times review was, I think, a very accurate notion that it's not so much the war between men and women that's dramatized as the war between men and themselves. So I find myself defending the play and the movie on relative to that aspect of it. And also, I find that in playing it, that I don't have, find myself running into reflections on that particular sentiment of some of misogyny. Yet there is clearly a destructive cycle that goes on in them. But again, even the aspect of it that's cocaine is one that I relate much more to, in the same way I would think, You know, when you look at some old Frank Sinatra movie, and everybody's having a drink. I don't think that's a movie about alcoholics any more than this is about drug addicts. This is a what is very common is this drug, not only in the 80s, but today I see it around, you know, just as much as I ever did in these settings. And it's a kind of, certainly a dialogue inducer, but I don't think that it dictates the drama.
You did Hurley Burley on stage and on screen. Did you see your character differently in the interim, you know, 12 years after you first played him?
I don't know that I could articulate the ways in which I saw it differently, but I could say that like with any good writing, there's an ongoing experience where you keep sort of discovering new things. Yet this was a movie that we made, you know, with very, very little short funds, and made the whole movie in 30 days. So there wasn't an awful lot of experimenting when it came time to shoot the scenes. We had to be pretty sure of the choices we were going to make and go ahead and do them. We wouldn't be able to have, you know, five takes per setup even to be able to adjust options so much. So in a way, if there was anything most different about the production of the play, where you're consistently trying new things and so on. In this case, major scenes are shot in one day's shooting, and you're pretty much committing to one choice or another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sean Penn. He's starring in the new movies Hurley Burley and The Thin Red Line. Your new movie, The Thin Red Line, is a World War II movie set in the South Pacific, and it's about the soldiers who are sent to the South Pacific island of Guadalcanal, which has been taken over by the Japanese. And, you know, the war and all of its machinery and death is set against the beauty of this island and the peaceful nature of the people living there. Would you describe your character in the film?
This is a question that is so much better put to Terry Malick, because the way that he works, this is somebody I have a great admiration and affection for. He's, but the way that he works, I think that if I, it's hard to describe my own participation in any other terms than to sort of give him something that was neutral enough that he could use it to write a character in the cutting room. There was as we went along, we tried to develop some specific aspects of, you know, what part this character was going to play in telling the story. But we didn't, it was never very clear what the specific arc of that telling was going to be. So scene for scene, it was a different experience than normally you would have, where you sort of graph a character. So I think that, you know, if there's somebody that's behind that, it's Terry much more than me, and he's unreachable for comment, but he's
that's right.
He's the one to put that to.
I'll try to sum up your character in the movie. Have you seen the movie, by the way?
I have.
You have, okay. I'll try to sum up the character, and I'm always afraid I reduce things to cliche when I do this, but here we go. I mean, it's kind of a classic character in a way, the guy who seems kind of tough and distant, but, you know, would risk his life in a second to save, you know, someone in his company. And then there's this line where someone asks him if he ever gets lonely, and he says something like, only when I'm around other people.
Yeah.
You know, there's some, especially early in the movie, there's a lot of close-ups of faces in the film. And I'm wondering, when you're acting, if you're aware of when you're going to have a tight close-up like that, and if that affects the kind of performance you give for that scene.
Again, I think that really, that varies movie to movie, scene to scene. And I know that there, I can't say for sure whether I'm one of the people that this is true of or not, but I know there's several close-ups in that picture that were, you know, initially in response to something other than what the point of view that was cut into it represents. So you're taking one train of thought that's going on in someone's face and applying it to a new setting in the editorial process, which is something that Terry may at times be very conscious he's going to do later. I don't really know. Again, he was somebody who I enjoy him partly because there's not an awful lot of chatter you can have about his process because it's not one that he can really talk about. It's something that goes on inside his head. So trying to second guess that stuff would be a mistake. So in the case of this movie, I would say that I don't know that I was particularly conscious of making adjustments based on the size of the frame.
My guest is Sean Penn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sean Penn. He's starring in the new movie Hurley Burley, set in Hollywood, and The Thin Red Line, set in Guadalcanal in World War II. Did you see a lot of war movies when you were growing up?
I suppose I saw my share. Now, mind you, that means mostly contemporary movies, because most of the older movies, and this goes back to my view of something like, you know, not just war movies, but even, you know, classic films like, you know, Grapes of Wrath and some of these things, I don't like them very much. You know, I don't really find that I respond to them cinematically very much, and that has been true also with some of the older films. And I did see From Here to Eternity, which has some sort of entertaining things in it and all. But I feel like it's packed with cliches, and it's not really the kind of filmmaking I'm interested in. So probably the contemporary films about war have been of more interest to me. I like Sam Fuller's movies.
Right, right. And you've been in two war movies that I can think of, Casualties of War, which is a Vietnam film shot directed by Brian De Palma, and, of course, now Thin Red Line. Would you maybe compare for us what the experience of shooting both of those films was like? There were battle scenes in both of those films that you were in. Can you compare the experience of how you were directed or what your sense of being in the midst of battle was in both of those scenes? One's World War II, one's Vietnam.
Well, I think that Brian De Palma, my sense of him as a director is that he has a kind of story he wants to tell, often with composition and camera movement. And he's a very operatic filmmaker, I think. Which at times I think is very effective, and at other times I'm not sure that it's the most effective way of working. That was a script I thought was very interesting also, which was also written by David Rabe.
Right, who did Hurley Burley.
Right. And so in some ways there was, one felt very free on Casualties of War in the sense that if you were standing in the part of the composition that Brian was interested in capturing, from that point on, he wasn't that concerned about what nuances you may bring as an actor to the part. Whereas with Terry, I find that Terry Malick's a director that people look at throughout the day, trying to find out what part of the journey he's on and how to serve the piece that he's making. So you find yourself observing Terry's search and trying to kind of grasp onto it. But I think the simpler answer to your question is both the movies were shot in, you know, tropical jungles, and I like tropical jungles a lot.
I'm wondering if it's disorienting to be in a scene with, you know, when there's fighting and bombs or grenades or a lot of gunfire. And the purpose of the scene is, in a way, to show the confusion of the battlefield. Is it confusing to be an actor in the middle of that?
Well, that's there's the old story about the actor who gets his first part, and his line is, you know, he's on the hill with the cannons, and the cannons go off, and his line is, "Hark, I hear the cannons roar," and he's practicing it over and over in his trailer, and finally they call him to the set, and action, and the cannon goes off. He says, "What the hell was that?" So, you know.
Right.
that's out there, but I find that when you know that those things are going to be there, for me, I've always found that those things can really be a barometer of where your attention has to be and sort of define where your concentration will be. I think that it makes sense for that to be disorienting if this is a soldier in his first battle, or if this is somebody who has not been in the training of that kind of situation. But if you've been around it a lot, as certainly the characters I've played in these pictures had been, then I think that you're really focusing on dealing with it as a danger that's bigger than you can actually deal with. You're a little bit in the hands of something bigger than you are at that point, and so you try to just do your job. I mean, I think that even in a character in a war picture is somebody who has a job, and there is training that goes along with that job, and there are ways that you adjust to situations. I think your focus is on those doing your job out there, doing the job in that case of a soldier.
I'd read that years ago you told Terrence Malick that Terrence Malick hadn't made a movie in 20 years before Thin Red Line, and you had told him at some point that if he ever made a movie again, you'd like to be in it, and that you would do it for a dollar. What was it about his movies that inspired that enthusiasm? And he had made Badlands and Days of Heaven.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was his movies that were among those that I had come to right around the time that cinema, as it were, was starting to interest me anyway. And that they were pivotal in my interest in film, which began as an interest in direction. And they really stuck with me, and I reviewed them over the years. And there was a certain kind of true poetry to the way that he made movies that I thought was so missing in other people's filmmaking, and that he was really important that way. And I found it very inspiring. And so those are the people I think that you support.
He gave up making films for 20 years. Now, you've said in recent interviews that you would like to give up acting. I assume that means that you'd still direct, but you'd just prefer not to.
Yeah, yeah. I love to make movies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you talked to him about his 20 years of not making movies and got a sense of what his experience not making movies was like, and if that affected your thoughts on not acting.
Well, I mean, I take Terry at his word when he describes it as he forgot to make a movie. So he remembered he was made movies, and he came back and he made ones.
He really sounds like a character.
He's a very interesting man.
So tell me more about why you want to stop acting. And I mean, I've been reading about this in recent articles about you.
I just don't enjoy it.
Is it because other people are controlling the whole film and you're just an actor in it, or is it that you don't like acting?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, one of the things, the most important thing I could share with you about it, I think, is something that I'm not going to be the only one to face. I mean, audiences have already paying the price of the fact that the things that one would act in are by and large so compromised by the time they are made. And they're compromised by the actors that do them, and they're compromised by the directors, and they're compromised by the writers. And some of it I understand, and some of it I blame them for. There's a self-imposed censorship that happens when people write, and they are aware of what studios will finance and what they won't finance. Those who write take on what they like to consider as the courageous subjects. There are ways to dramatize courageous subjects that make them cowardly. And that's by and large the way that important issues are addressed by filmmakers today. They find a way to soften them. They find a way to allow an audience to be comfortable. And I think that whenever it was that filmmaking became the art of massage, is when I got less and less interested in participating in it as an actor. So that's where material has been a key to me not being interested. It's just not there. And rare is the day that you get something and you usually don't get paid well to do it, because you have to really fight to get it done. And this is, I've had a long history of those, and it beats you up. And I think that, I think the way that critics do not look past those, I think critics think very much like studios do. I would venture to say that I can't think of a critic who I have any feelings of support for. Those who have ever said anything good about me, that I might appreciate at one moment, come out the next minute and say something so ridiculous about something or are so unsupportive of someone's terrific piece of work somewhere along the line. You sit down, you think to these people have no real grounded notion of what it is that their job is, and that's very frustrating. So the whole world of film today has become, you know, when I grew up watching films, I think in the 70s were probably the last time one could say that of the 10 most successful pictures that came out each year, 8 of them were probably the best films that came out that year. Now, of the 10 most successful films, none of them are among the 10 best. That distance has grown and grown. And I just feel that I can do what I want to do much more directly as a writer and as a director.
Well, let me ask you, I this is in a way asking you to play film critic for a moment, but since your most recent movie is a film set during World War II, I'm wondering if you saw Saving Private Ryan, which is one of the most commercially and critically successful films of the year and probably won a whole lot of Academy Awards. Do you think that was a good film?
Let me not talk specifically about Saving Private Ryan, but there is one contribution that I would like to make to the ridiculous world of films' self-acknowledgement with awards. I think they should have an award every year for best half movie of the year.
Why?
Because I think there are a lot of filmmakers that are capable of, since have very skillful and maybe even artful at times, who do not trust audiences, do not trust their material enough to tell something truly from start to finish. And so what they do in an extraordinary fashion is betrayed by the pandering of the rest of the storytelling.
I'd like to start giving an award for best performances in mediocre or formulaic movies, because I find that there's a lot of really terrific performances in movies that are not really worthy of the actors who are in them.
Yeah, that's true too.
So do you get sent a lot of scripts and you think this is dreck?
Yes.
My guest is Sean Penn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sean Penn. He's starring in the new movies Hurly Burly and The Thin Red Line. I want to ask you a question about President Clinton and about the way his relationship with Monica Lewinsky has been handled. I know that the people opposing him would make the case that this is about perjury and it's not about sex, but nevertheless, no matter which side of the fence you're on, it's quite clear that a sexual relationship has been made very, very public in his life. You are a celebrity, a Hollywood star, whose personal life has been the subject of a lot of press. You had paparazzi who were nearly stalking you for quite a while. And I'm wondering, as someone who has probably felt much more exposed than you wanted to be and much more under surveillance than you wanted to be, if that's affecting your perception of President Clinton's story.
Well, I, you know, clearly I wouldn't be able to tell you how I would feel if I hadn't had those experiences, but I'd like to think that it would be the way that I feel without, you know, with having had them. You know, I think what's interesting about it to me is it's such a, is that in the way that the support continues for him despite it, the thing that I think is most, that I'm most optimistic about because of that is that we still seem as a culture to finally want at the end of the day most to celebrate survival. And anybody who can stand there and take the punches that this guy has taken, forget about whether you believe in his policy, forget if you think that a president is or isn't an ineffectual pawn of multinational corporate interest anymore. If he's nothing else, he's a symbol of incredible resilience. And I think that that's very good for this country.
Sean Penn, the last time we did an interview, you had to leave the Los Angeles studio because it's a no-smoking studio. So we ended up doing it by phone from your place, which is how we're doing it today as well. You still smoking?
I have let my daughter know that I'll be quitting.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Is she old enough to pressure you? Or?
Oh, yeah. They turn them into little anarchists at schools now.
So what?
They encourage them to throw your packs in the sink and put water in them and throw them in the trash bin and all of that.
So what strat? Are you going to do that thing where, yeah, you moisten the cigarettes in the sink and then you... I remember there was a time when people used to carry around jars with cigarette stubs in it, and when they got the urge to smoke, they were supposed to open up the jar and inhale all the old cigarette stubs in the hopes that would nauseate them.
Well, you're nauseating me just bringing it up.
So what's your technique going to be?
Cold turkey.
Cold turkey. Well, I wish you luck with it.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for talking with us about your new movies.
You bet.
Sean Penn is starring in The Thin Red Line and Hurley Burley. He'll play a jazz musician in Woody Allen's next film. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui Westman, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Chicago and New Orleans are trying to cut down on shootings by suing the gun industry. More cities are expected to sue this year. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss these lawsuits and the gun industry's reaction. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.